Welcome to the SearchHealthIT.com podcast, where SearchHealthIT.com editors interview leading experts on IT strategies for healthcare leaders.
My name is Jean DeGarian, editorial director with SearchHealthIT, and I have the pleasure of introducing the next session today, BYOD for Healthcare, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I'm excited to introduce our speaker for this session, Dr. John Halanka, CIO of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and leading BYOD and healthcare guru all around extraordinaire. Dr. Halanka, thank you very much for joining us today. Please take it away.
Great. Well, I'm very happy to be here. I recognize that there are many topics I could discuss about meaningful use and interoperability and standards, but given the importance of regulatory and compliance concerns and the likelihood that health information exchanges are going to involve mobile devices, I thought today I would talk about our mobile device security experience, the journey that we're on, challenges we're encountering, some of the costs that we're experiencing. So the CIOs throughout the country who are trying to deal with the BYOD challenge will learn from what we've done right and what we've done wrong. So let's take it away. So first, you could be a pundit and say, BYOD, oh, it's just a transient phenomenon. It'll go away. Or, I know, let's develop a policy banning the use of mobile devices in the hospital. Well, my experience overseeing 3,000 physicians and 12,000 employees is that BYOD is here to stay. I'm seeing not only do people have one device, but they have maybe two devices, and maybe in the near future, three or more devices. These devices are being used, of course, for personal communications and personal apps, but they all have web browsers, and they're being used to access corporate assets. Some of them are being used to sync corporate email. And so the challenge is this. In an academic health center, such as I work in, where there is a positive sense of academic freedom and collaboration and a desire to exchange information with colleagues, how do you balance the need for security and protection of privacy with this BYOD phenomenon? Well, one could issue devices from a corporate central procurement point. The challenge, of course, is that these devices are very personal. Some people like iPhones, some people like Android, some people like Blackberries. Some people want sub-notebooks, some people want laptops, some people like tablets or iPads. There's a huge diversity of devices out there, and I wish I could say there's a one-size-fits-all product or one-size-fits-all approach that could encrypt and protect all these devices. Then the reality is there's not. For many years, Beth Israel Deaconess has had strong policies, which I'll review with you, about the use of mobile devices, everything from laptops to USB drives. How is it that you access clinical information remotely? What if you're traveling, you're in a hotel, where is it safe, what do you do? What we've discovered is the malware problem, screen scraping and keyloggers, and the nature of mobile devices storing unencrypted data locally is so significant that policy is not enough. We've had so many examples over the last couple of years where policy, although extraordinarily well-intended and our employees trying to comply, just couldn't. Example, you have a home computer, a laptop, and you use that laptop to access your corporate email or to look up clinical information. Oh, that home laptop also happens to be used by your 12-year-old son who downloads apps from the internet. Well, you probably know that 20% of commercial websites these days are infected with malware. It is extraordinarily common for legitimate commercial websites to be the vectors of malware that ends up on a mobile device and employs a screen scraper or keystroke logger that then takes your credentials as you're typing them into your email client or clinical application and sends them to China. And then that Chinese hacker intercepts those credentials, logs in as you, sends a million spam, and before you know it, your entire email system is blacklisted on the internet. Or worse, that patient confidentiality is somehow compromised. So this is the nature of what CIOs have to deal with. We have limited authority often, but infinite accountability We have BYOD devices of all shapes and sizes coming into the organization. We've tried policy. We need technological controls. But products like mobile device management applications can be very expensive, $50 or $100 or more per device. Today, I have over 5,000 mobile devices accessing the Beth Israel Deaconess Network. So just imagine the annual operating cost of 5,000 devices times $50, not easy to fit into the IT budget. So what do? Well, sure, you start with policy and education and ensuring that there's this culture of security and respect for privacy is incredibly important. So let's take a look at our existing policy. So we follow the Massachusetts data protection laws, which we respect federal and state laws equally, but the Massachusetts laws actually tend to be a bit more restrictive and cover not only patient-identified data or protected health information, but person-identified data. So in fact, if you were to use a mobile or BYOD device and you had information of the home address, the Social Security number, anything that might be construed as important or used in identity theft of a person on the device, Massachusetts state law says you must encrypt that device. So we followed the law and said, where technically feasible, users will apply the following safeguards to mobile devices that connect to the BIDMC network where they access any protected data, person or patient data. So of course they need password protection, and many mobile devices, in fact just about every mobile device these days, does have the capacity to put on some kind of PIN or password. So that's straightforward, not a lot of controversy there. Timeout periods. So that if you leave that device on a bus and it's logged in, you'd hope that after a minute or two, it logs out, and therefore, should an individual find the device, there is little chance that the contents of the device could be compromised. Not very controversial either, though some users would tend to send the timeouts to a 10-minute or a longer period of time, because the typing of the PIN code over and over as you're checking your device multiple times can be a bit of a hassle. No more than 10 password attempts before the device content is wiped. This is a controversial point. So imagine that you are visiting your grandchildren, they pick up your iPad or your iPhone, and they begin typing numbers. And what do you know, in just a minute or two, your entire device has become the iPhone brick. It is wiped of all data. Also challenging is the fact that sometimes these devices contain important personal documents, photos, recordings, etc., as well as the corporate information we're trying to protect. But unless you install one of these expensive mobile device management solutions, you really can't segregate the device into that personal and corporate, you know, individual partitions. So the auto wipe applies to everything equally. So your grandchildren play with the device and you've lost not only your email, but all those personal photos. So a bit controversial, but our argument is putting a 4-character password on your device is pretty useless unless you have some kind of limit on the number of tries before an auto wipe, because by definition, all you need to do is try 9,999 different numeric strings of numbers, and eventually you will get into the device. So you need an auto wipe. Updating the device with antivirus or other security software is important. Now, I'm sure like many CIOs, you've found that antivirus software isn't as effective as it used to be. These days, viruses can be self-modifying. You can get new variants appearing every few seconds. The signature method, which looked at a static virus and created a digest and then found a marker for that virus, just doesn't work as well. Viruses are introduced too frequently, mutate too quickly. So, of course, we still use antivirus software. It just is of limited utility. Encrypting protected data. Now, as we go through some of the details of our program, you'll see where this is a big challenge. If you look at the encryption that exists on an iPhone, for example, iPhone 4S has encryption. All you do is activate your password, and as soon as you have password protection on the device, there are elements of the iPhone memory which are encrypted. However, it turns out that the key for that encryption is actually stored on the iPhone device itself. So this is a bit like locking your front door and putting the key under the mat. Is it secure? Well, the front door is locked. If anyone looks under the mat, however, you don't have a very secure home. And there are jailbreaking utilities that can be used to access an iPhone and retrieve encryption keys. So the encryption is only modestly useful on iPhones. There are some versions of iPhones, like the 2 and the 3, that actually don't support encryption. And so there's this diversity of approaches to encryption, the strength of encryption. Some Android devices are good, some Android devices are bad. We've certainly had issues where individuals want to use devices on our network which are incapable of being encrypted. And of course, I get to be the very popular guy and saying, I'm so happy you bought the Droid X. You can use it as a doorstop. You could give it to your kids, but you can't use it on the corporate network. Sorry. Disabling unnecessary services. So if you walk into a hospital and you've got Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, whole variety of applications running, it's a bit hard for us to control what goes in and out of that mobile device. And certainly, infected mobile devices can communicate to other mobile devices and often cause infections to spread. So disable protocols you are not using. And to the extent it's technically possible, installing a device firewall, some kind of protection that's going to limit the amount of inbound and outbound traffic on the device to those things that you think are appropriate. So interesting aspect of this policy is it was written a couple of years ago, and it says, where technically feasible. As you'll see in the upcoming slides, we've now gone a bit stronger than that and actually created a mandatory encryption and protection policy with no exceptions that applies to all devices. Other things that you should think about are physical security. So keeping that mobile device in your possession. I mean, how many times have in your organization you had issues where a vendor or employee brought their laptop home with them at night, put it in a locked car, only to find a broken window and the device gone? So you really need to secure that device. Don't keep it in a car. Put it in a trunk. Put it in a locked room in your home. If you leave it in an office, keep the office locked. So clear that you must have physical security to complement the logical security. You don't want the unauthorized people to use your files stored on the device or gain access to the network. So you need to ensure that you aren't handing off your device pre-logged in to somebody else. Should you have a loss of the device, it's really important to notify both the IT folks and the public safety folks pretty rapidly, because we may be able to recover the device. Very common in urban areas for those drug seekers who steal laptops to pawn them. And so certainly we have mechanisms of trying to discover a device in a pawn shop to ensure if there are things like LoJack or similar technologies that were looking for the device being powered on or connected to a network. So early notification is important. And then at the end of life, disposing of a device appropriately is important, because the last thing that you want is a device with person or patient identified data ending up in a landfill where somebody retrieves it and then a privacy breach occurs. And certainly we've all heard about issues of devices, hard drives, backup tapes, and other things ending up in landfills and patient privacy being threatened. So that policy it's pretty good, but the challenge is this. Let's say, today, it's fall of 2012, and a new Apple device is likely to be introduced in the next few weeks. Well, how will that device support encryption? Will the users who buy it know how to encrypt it? Even though our users are aware of this policy, technology evolves so fast that they may not be able to adequately protect the personal technologies they are procuring. And again, love personal technologies, think they're very empowering, think they're essential for delivering timely care in a hospital setting, but often folks buy these devices unaware that these devices truly represent a compliance and regulatory nightmare, that there's a huge risk, and they're not really sure how to go in the device and activate the settings necessary to protect them. So in the past, we, of course, did education, we did policy, we did assistance, but then there was a catalyst that caused us to change our approach to the protection of healthcare information on mobile devices. One of our clinicians bought a laptop at the Apple Store, loaded email and other personal files on that device, left that device sitting on a desk in an office with an unlocked door, and this being a medical office building, well, a person, actually a known criminal, walked in, went up, was thought by many to be a patient, tried unlocked doors, happened to find the device, grabbed it from the desk, and left the building. Now, subsequently, we did arrest the individual because we had caught on videotape the identity of this individual and a known criminal in our community, but by that time, the laptop was gone. The laptop did have a LoJack-type device, but it was never activated. So we were faced with a situation of a physician's device filled with email and filled with personal files that needed substantial forensics to analyze what was on this device, because the device was not encrypted. It was a violation of the policy I just showed you. And what, on average, is the cost of such a stolen laptop? The answer is about $300,000. When you look at the necessary security, forensics, if there is a reportable breach, patient notification, protection services like credit monitoring, and so this consumed our security folks, our compliance folks for weeks, and we did full notification of the press, we did full notification of the various state and federal authorities, we went through various site visits from those authorities, all because this individual did not click the File Vault 2 encryption checkbox that is available on every modern Apple computer. So this was a teachable moment. So as CIOs, we recognize that although we don't purchase these devices, the BYOD is personal, we are ultimately accountable for what data spills occur because of them. And so because of that accountability, because of the visibility of this particular catalyst event, the stealing of a laptop, we developed a very new and aggressive approach enterprise-wide to securing mobile devices that are used to access personal information. So let's go through what we did. So of course, there were some things that were easy. We used the teachable moment to enhance our educational efforts, to remind individuals about federal and state laws. And because of the event, we told them there are certain kinds of protocols that we will now restrict on our network. So it turns out that the IMAP and POP protocols for email are insecure and actually very challenging to manage. I can't use IMAP or POP to check on the encryption status of the device you're using to access your email. And so by enforcing the use of ActiveSync, we have Microsoft Exchange, I can say only synchronize email to encrypted, password-protected, timed-out devices. And if an individual tries to sync email and does not have settings that are appropriate, I can actually push settings to the device and change the encryption on the device, and I can ensure that individuals in the future don't go back and turn off encryption. So there are some things one can do at a server level or a corporate network level that now enforce your policy, or technology enforcing policy. But there's much more to do. There are thousands of mobile devices that have been purchased over the last 5 years by researchers using discretionary funds and grants, by individuals who may have gifts. And so we don't, in IT, have a complete inventory of all those things that were purchased outside of the usual IT procurement processes. So we broke our project for encryption and protection of mobile devices into two phases. Phase one focuses on devices that were acquired in some mechanism through the corporation. So we went through our PeopleSoft accounts payable purchasing logs, looked for all technology purchases that had been done with discretionary funds and grants, identified all individuals that had laptops and various types of tablets or devices that would be capable of storing data in a mobile fashion where encryption was necessary. We contacted every one of those folks, and I'll go through the details of what we ended up setting up as depots to do encryption. And by the end of September, we will be done with encrypting every single device in the entire empire that was purchased through discretionary funds. At the same time we're working on laptops, we also want to begin working on smartphones. Now, as I said, with ActiveSync, we were able to turn off certain protocols and mandate certain settings on your device, so encryption, password protection, timeout, etc. And that works pretty well on modern iPhones. Android devices turned out to be much more problematic. Some Android devices work, some Android devices don't. So in our first phase, we're only looking at the subset of Android devices that do work well with ActiveSync. Some do require a third-party product like Touchdown in order to do encryption. That encryption is not whole disk, it's just partial. So there's a lot of complexity in trying to deal with Android devices. Phase two, and this is where we're getting really rigorous, we recognize that we are ultimately responsible for privacy spills that occur because of BYOD devices you may have in your home that are used to access corporate data. So again, you really only have two choices. You could say, I will ban all remote access of all corporate information on a BYOD device that's used in the home. And the challenge is, in a complex academic medical center with thousands of employees and huge amounts of research, it's really challenging to just say, I will block all access. So instead, what we are doing is we are encrypting every single personal device that we, as I go through these depots in a moment, you'll hear about, have staff that will take devices, ensure that settings are right, that encryption is in place, and return those devices rapidly to their owner. And that second phase will include tablets, laptops, iPads, smartphones, etc. Now, once we encrypt everything, then we require individuals who renew their password every 6 months to say, yes, I have kept my mobile devices encrypted. If I acquired a new mobile device, I brought it to the depot encrypted it. I assure you that I am only accessing confidential information, person information, via an encrypted device. So by educating and then helping and then requiring attestation, we've really tried to create a culture where individuals recognize their responsibility to only use encrypted devices to access person-identified data. So let's go through exactly what we did in creating these depots. Like many IT organizations, we have far more demand than supply. My internal staff is at times overwhelmed, so we took a few $100,000 from projects that we could slow down and applied that to purchasing outsourced experts to staff multiple locations throughout the medical center that will provide encryption services. And we had some internal management, but largely augmented our staff with external staff. And those depots, well, we started in the Center for Life Sciences, which is a research building where there are many discretionary mobile devices, and we learned a lot. And we found that the devices that were brought to us were quite heterogeneous, had quite a lot of variations in their operating systems and their security protections and their antivirus configuration. And so we thought we were going to, at first pass, even with this large augmented staff, go through each device, ensure it was encrypted, ensure that it had no malware, ensure that all applications and antivirus were up to date. But because of the heterogeneity, we couldn't quite do everything. So we focused on encryption. And there were many different approaches we had to use for encryption. So example, if you're running Windows XP, there is no native encryption. And so we had to add an application, in this case, McAfee's endpoint product, which enabled us to encrypt the drive as well as have a central management console where we could recover the drive, if necessary, unencrypted at an enterprise level. If you're running an older Mac, chances are, you need to upgrade to Lion or a modern operating system that allows the FileVault 2 application to be used on the Mac. But some Macs are so old, they don't actually really run the new operating system. So then what do? Oh, you look to a product like PGP, the Pretty Good Privacy Whole Disk Encryption. What if you are running an iPad or an iPhone? Well, those are straightforward. You just add the password. It does a self-encrypt. That encryption isn't the strongest, but it probably meets the letter of the law for encryption of the device should it be lost or stolen. Windows, modern versions of Windows, like Windows 7 Enterprise, do include BitLocker so that you can activate encryption. So in the case of some Windows devices, we would upgrade them. And sometimes you just have no choice but to actually replace the hard drive on the device with a self-encrypting drive. So the idea is, we XP, we've got some software, most Apples, we have some software. Modern Apples, modern Windows, you've got some options in the operating systems. Linux, a little challenging. We would use a piece of hardware that in effect encrypts the data at a hardware level so that you don't really have to worry about supporting a software application. So to my point, there isn't a magic bullet. There isn't one size fits all that will just take care of all of your mobile devices across all operating systems. You need this multi-product approach, and we chose the smallest number of products that would cover all of our possibilities. So I went through a number of these already, the BitLocker, FileVault, McAfee, self-encrypting drives, and sometimes we would upgrade operating systems. A question, of course, the CIO needs to ask is, who bears the cost? And this was a very challenging question for us to ask. And what we recognized is if upgrading an operating system costs $50 or buying a license to a piece of software costs $30 versus the cost of dealing with a breach, which is $300,000 per incident, it just made sense for this enterprise-wide encryption program for the IS department to absorb the cost of all the necessary labor and all the necessary software to bring all of our devices to a level of encryption that would keep us out of the newspaper, that would keep us trustworthy, that would keep our patient data safe. On occasion, we actually did even have to buy new devices for individuals who had devices so old that none of these techniques would work for them. But that was a very limited number of individuals. Our phase two, as I said, expands now to include personal devices. So as the depots today are open from 8 to 5 and you bring your device in, the work is done, you get it by the end of the day, you'll bring in your personal device and we'll do the same. There are challenges, especially with older hardware and diverse operating systems and non-standard software, and there are licensing costs here. And so although we are nearly complete with phase one, and I know the costs there and they've been relatively constrained, we are not yet in phase two. And that is, when I'm asked how much will it cost and how long will it take, it's a bit of an unknown because when you're dealing with thousands of employees and thousands devices, we're not quite sure what we're going to encounter. So definitely be more lessons learned that I'll be reporting on my blog as we go through phase two. So I went through the notion of attestation. And with attestation, in effect, what you're asking the individual is to take accountability. So as I mentioned, CIOs have limited authority, but we do have ultimate accountability. When it came time to report to the Boston Globe the theft of the physician's laptop, it was purchased at the Apple store without my knowledge, I was the spokesperson. I was the person who told the story. I was the person that accepted accountability and responsibility for something I had absolutely no control over. It's just the nature of our regulatory and compliance environment. It's the covered entity, in this case, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, that's ultimately responsible for any privacy breaches of data involving its patients. By doing attestation, you really are, in some ways, shifting some accountability to the individual because they are forced to attest that they have taken a device that you have encrypted, kept it physically secure, doing everything they can to support the policy. So should that encrypted device get stolen, in effect, you get a HIPAA pass. That is, you aren't forced to do a public breach reporting on a fully encrypted device. Of course, we would much rather have it such that no patient-identified data is stored on mobile devices and that mobile devices aren't lost or stolen, but just the ubiquity of the BYOD devices, the number of thefts, the likelihood is events will still occur, and encryption provides us a means of protection. So future considerations, what else do we want to do? Well, as I mentioned, it certainly would be nice to be able to segregate the personal device into a corporate side and a personal side. So should we need to do an automated wipe, or should we need to deactivate the device for any reason, that we're able to do that on a corporate partition and not the personal partition. And that does require the acquisition of mobile device management software. I hear a lot of mixed reviews about mobile device management software. Not only is it expensive, but it sometimes can negatively affect the user experience, sometimes can be challenging to manage. And so we have not yet purchased a mobile device management solution. We certainly are continuing to watch the marketplace as these software systems evolve. But one also assumes that the manufacturers of mobile devices will provide additional protections as they issue new versions of devices. We're watching that too. Do you allow an individual to persist their entire email store on a mobile device? Now, many of us work remotely. We may work in a disconnected environment. So certainly it's nice to be able to download all of your email and work on it when disconnected. The challenge, of course, is that all it takes is an email about a patient, a PowerPoint that has person identified information embedded in it, a spreadsheet. Suddenly you have a major privacy breach on your hands. And so we want to be very careful about what protocols we support. And again, with ActiveSync, we can check to see if your device is encrypted before allowing you to download email to it. We're also looking at such things as our SSL VPN client and saying, maybe we should block laptops from downloading using standard Microsoft MAPI or other protocols or the Exchange Web Services protocol for Macs until the SSL VPN has verified that that mobile device is encrypted. So thinking through how to protect email is important. A lot of individuals use their devices for social networking. And you, of course, want to be very careful that you don't have person or patient identified data intermixed with social networking applications. I mean, it may sound far-fetched, but yes, you might find doctors in the hospital doing things like using a social networking site to do consultations about patients. Of course, that is forbidden. You might find doctors using social networking on mobile devices while in the middle of patient care, creating a distracted doctoring problem. And I've written about that in some academic literature. You want to be very careful that you have a good social networking policy in place that's going to ensure that mobile devices are used appropriately while business is being conducted. And so we are refining our social networking policy now. Cloud storage. Well, as more and more folks exchange more and more data on more and more devices, they're going to look for creative ways to back it up. And do you really want your corporate intellectual property on Dropbox? Do you really want patient-identified data on SugarSync? You know, these are the sorts of questions you need to ask, and we are seriously looking at blocking all cloud storage options on our network, instead providing corporate cloud storage that individuals can use so that we prevent the leakage of person-identified data to non-HIPAA-compliant, non-business associate-operated cloud storage facilities. And of course, all of this is change. All of this is, it feels like restriction of freedom. BYOD is all about the right to choose your own device and your own applications. And the CIO is not so popular when the CIO suddenly tells you what you can and cannot do with the personal device that you own. And so we have to phase this in a thoughtful fashion with education along the way so that change management feels, well, acceptable, that there's an understanding that it's in the interests of protecting patient data and patient privacy and institutional reputation and quality and safety that we're step by step restricting what mobile devices can do. As meaningful use encourages us to exchange more and more data for more and more purposes, regulatory and compliance restrictions, HIPAA and high tech and various state laws, build greater civil penalties or various corporate responsibilities for protecting that data. So you recognize we're all on this journey. And I wish it was easy, but as I said in the title slide, BYOD is good, BYOD is bad, and encryption can be very ugly. And so I encourage you, you know, to begin your own security program on mobile devices if you haven't done so already, recognizing the threat is real, the costs are significant, and unless you are forearmed, you will find yourself in the newspaper in a not-so-friendly way. So I'm happy to take your questions. I do blog every day about these kinds of issues, and I do try to be pretty transparent because, as I said at the beginning, I'm hopeful that CIOs throughout the country can learn from what we've done right and especially from what we've done wrong. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dr. Halamka. It was a great presentation. We're going to move now to the live question answer portion of today's session. We encourage you to enter your questions in the Ask a Question area. We're going to respond to as many questions as we can. Thank you.
Hello, this is Don Fluckinger from Search Health IT with live with Dr. Halamka. What a great informative presentation there. We have some questions rolling in, but I'm going to start with one that I thought of while you gave your presentation. How do you sell the auto wipe of a personal device after 10 password tries that are unsuccessful? That must seem to be something pretty hard pill for employees to swallow.
Well, and you're quite correct. This is one of those that isn't the, oh, that's wonderful, you're going to erase all my personal data. It has to be sold in terms of risk. And that is, if you look at the compliance and regulatory environment today, the cost of a stolen mobile device can run $300,000 or $500,000 when you're looking at legal and forensics and patient notification. So you say to the person, you are ultimately responsible for your personal device. There could be hundreds of thousands of dollars of penalties. Some could even possibly accrue to you. Or we can just ensure that we auto wipe the device after 10 tries, because if you put a 4-character password on it, all somebody has to do is try 9,999 times and they're in and privacy is breached. And with that understanding of risk and responsibility, people have accepted the auto wipe feature.
So a attendee question here. How long did it take to get buy-in from the physicians, and at what level did that come from?
It turned out to be actually relatively quick. I think it was Rahm Emanuel who said, never let any crisis go unused, or something to that effect. When you have a sentinel event, a laptop theft, That is a catalyst for change, and that's really what happened with us, is that a physician's individual purchased device was stolen, and the entire physician community became aware of the nature of the consequences of such a device with costs and patient notification and reputation, et cetera. And so hence there was broad support at the medical executive committee level across all the senior clinician leadership to move forward with this initiative. I think the person who asked the question is quite right. If you didn't have a sentinel event, if people didn't understand the risks, it would be a harder sell. So your choice is have something bad happen and then mitigate, or try an aggressive education program to get buy-in.
Yeah. Another attendee asks, I work in a similar environment to yours. We use Citrix for much of our access, especially remote access, which can be utilized from any device with an internet connection. We do not allow access to the local drive for remote access, but that doesn't keep someone from taking screenshots or storing email locally. How do you address this type of scenario with your policy?
Sure. Well, a couple of issues. Is that Citrix is a quite fine application for thick client applications that can't run locally. And Citrix has been used in many industry-leading corporations as a mechanism of protecting security of intellectual property that they wish inside the firewall. One challenge I think we all have is that doctors are extraordinarily impatient people, and the startup time for a Citrix session and sometimes the instability of a Citrix session over a flaky network connection can be a real disincentive to doctor buy-in of Citrix. So we have a combination that we've used, Citrix for some of those thick client applications, no other way to get to them, and then web-based applications that can be used anywhere on any device, and then telling the clinicians, you have a policy requirement not to store data locally, not to do save as, not to do print screens, because you recognize that that creates a breach situation. Now, to mitigate the breach situation, what we've already done is encrypted the device, so should they save as or print screen, it's encrypted so that in some ways you do get around breach reporting requirements, but ultimately, you wonder if we're all going to have to go to some kind of virtual desktop infrastructure so that even if you were to print screen or save as, it disappears as the session ends. But virtual desktop really does have the same issue of Citrix as having a slow startup time and challenges over low bandwidth connections. One thing just to everybody, so everybody knows, meaningful use stage 2 local encryption requirements actually have specific language that says, yes, the product you use must keep any local data stored or any caching encrypted, but if a user does a print screen or a save as, that is really the responsibility of the user. That is not something that the vendor or the covered entity really has to take accountability for. It's the user's responsibility not to do that and to keep their client devices appropriately secured.
Well, speaking of client devices, there are so many out there, and you sort of went into the nuts and bolts of Android and iOS and sort of securing your network from their vulnerabilities. How do you sort of work that into the HIPAA risk assessment? Like when the iPhone 5 comes out, is there an iPhone 5 HIPAA risk assessment, or is it OS specific? How does that work?
Well, good news is the evolution of most of these operating systems is such that you have basic floor level encryption or security requirements at a given level of the operating system, and then as the operating system evolves, it just gets better and better. So as an example, what our HIPAA risk assessment says is that we believe we have adequate encryption protection on Apple iOS 4.1 or higher, Apple OS X 10.7 or higher, BlackBerry OS, all 200 users that are left in our enterprise, version 4.5 or higher, Windows 7 Professional or higher, and Android OS 2.34 or higher. So in that sense, what you've done is created a floor, and then as new devices are introduced, they just simply are grandfathered into that floor. I will make the comment about Android, is that although Apple controls iOS, single vendor control, You really, in a way, don't have a single vendor controlling iOS, so there's really no guarantee that new Android devices will actually work well with some of our server-side controls, like our ActiveSync Exchange enforcing encryption. So often what we find is that Android devices have to be tested just to make sure they'll even work. Not so much that the risk is going to be worse in the newer devices, but they just may not work.
I'm sure employees don't ask for a lot of advice, but do you have a recommended list of devices that you share when people say, which cell phone should I get, A or B?
The challenge with BYOD is that people see that this is their personal device. It's like telling people, we have decided that you should drive an economy car and Prius is the best choice. I mean, you just very challenging to do that. Everyone has different values and everybody has different needs, different applications, different form factors. So what we do is set policies about minimum functionality and how it is you should physically secure the device. And certainly we can provide the guidance I mentioned at an operating system level. But then ultimately it's up to the individual what they choose. And if they choose poorly, you could end up with a device that just doesn't work on the network. I mean, and, you know, if I had a recommendation to make, it's sure, you know, it's not that I'm an Apple fanboy or something. It just turns out that Apple devices are more predictable than some of the other mobile devices. We know how to control those. So probably the case is you buy an Apple device that it will run within the network. It will behave as we expect. With the others, we can't guarantee that.
Another question coming in. It sounds like meaningful use security risk assessment regarding encryption is the responsibility of client versus the vendor, you know, whether it's an EHR application or a lab system. Is this correct? For example, patient data passed over the network in TCP/IP protocol.
Right. So you're going to see the certification and testing criteria come out for meaningful use stage two in the next couple of months. And what we've been doing at the Standards Committee and its implementation work group is working closely with ONC on those testing criteria. And we will pilot them before they go live, unlike stage one where they came out quite quickly. We assume that the testing criteria will actually mandate the vendor to demonstrate the capacity of their software to locally encrypt data should that vendor's application require a local cache of data. So, you know, the question is correct in some ways. So I use thin client web applications with no caching. And so, you know, it's really not the application for me that is the worry. Is the person on the other end, the client device user, keeping their device appropriately protected? It's my responsibility. But if I were running a vendor product that kept a local data store, it really would be the vendor's responsibility to have an EHR that can protect that local data store.
Now, here's another question. I'm not exactly sure what this person is asking, but I bet you know. How do you control how terribly chatty software firewalls can be?
Right. So it's a really interesting question. What the person's getting at is that as you put on various protections on both the server side and the client side, they have overhead. And some protocols and some approaches send lots of data back and forth. The nature of that data might be, hello, I'm out here and I'm safe. Are you sure? Yes, I am. You know, it's just constantly going back and forth with chatty protocols. And certainly as we do all of our benchmarking of new technologies, we end up using appliances that we put out at client sites to look at the nature of bandwidth flows from their site to us and look at application performance. So we have tried to avoid the introduction of technologies that have such high overhead that they significantly impact network performance. This is an incredibly rapidly evolving technology stack, a huge moving target. I did earlier today give a keynote address to a number of venture capitalists who are specifically looking at mobile device management, mobile application management, virtual desktop type applications. They want to know what to invest in. My point is, today's gold star may be tomorrow's complete failure. You really have to just be sensitive to the fact that the technology in this whole space is changing daily, and do your best to select what you think is going to be a winner. In our case, we do a lot of pilots, we do a lot of testing, we look at things like simplicity of support and application performance, chattiness, these sorts of things before selecting a product.
And another one coming in. How can we protect medical devices from hackers? And that really isn't a BYOD thing yet, but I imagine in your position, you're anticipating that happening as more and more patients get their own medical devices and sensors, right?
They're all completely safe. It's not a concern. Just kidding. So this is a huge issue. And I'll answer it in two ways. There's the medical device that I buy from a vendor and use inside the four walls of the hospital. And then there's, of course, implantable medical devices. You would think that when you buy a device from a vendor, oh, it's like an appliance. It's like a toaster, right? Oh, it's self-contained. It's completely fine. Nope. A lot of these devices that you would buy, like EKG machines, IV pumps, imaging devices, they actually are things like Linux workstations running Apache from 5 years ago. And what happens, and it's a nasty problem for the country, is the FDA appropriately wants to look at the safety of medical devices, so it has 510K approval. And then the FDA says, okay, well, you've certified with us, you know, Apache version 1.0 running on Windows NT. Now, if you want to update that with a patch or a new level of operating system, you have to go through the certification program again at great expense over great time. So what you end up with is a lot of these appliance-type medical devices are security nightmares because they're unpatched older software. So what we've had to do is build network isolation around them, not connect them to the internet, put special monitors on intrusion detection and prevention systems for these devices, because it is very, very true that medical devices could in fact be the Virus Master 3000 spewing viruses all over your environment unless you isolate them. And lest you think that pacemakers or other implantable devices are safe, they are not. You'll find that they contain microprocessors, and they have some of the same memory overflow, buffer issues, SQL injection, I mean, every kind of hack you might imagine on an application in the data center is probably applicable to an implantable device, and that issue has not been well addressed yet.
Well, this has been really great. We have time for one more question, and an attendee writes in, how do you apply these policies to telehealth and two-way video consults? And I'm just imagining, you know, if I could do an e-visit with my physician over Skype on my iPad, that would be awesome, but the policy management for that must be kind of tough.
Well, absolutely, and the challenge is many telemedicine connections take place across state lines. And so this is a very evolving area, and you know, certainly what we do is recognize prudence and judgment is important. Try to persist as little data as possible. Recognize that there are many kinds of video technologies and some are safer than others. We've tried to standardize our telemedicine connectivity using certain protocols and software that we believe is reasonably well behaved. But I think the question really inherently says, policy is probably the best bet because technology at the moment is variable and laws across states are changing.
Thank you for listening to the searchhealthit.com podcast. For more information and resources about healthcare technology and electronic health records, please visit searchhealthit.com. Thank you.